Anglicanism is the one of the five tributaries that is most simpatico, most resonant with, most pleasing to fully emergent Christianity. They don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater entirely. Robert Weber was absolutely right. They're in pursuit of the ancient future. And the only way you're going to get the ancient future is to go to those who have it. And Roman Catholicism, even though about a quarter, actually probably about 22% of emergence Christians, and there's some pretty good data to support that figure, about 22% of emergence Christianity right now in this country is natal Roman Catholic, claims some sort of natal beginning with RC. Wow. Even though that's true, Roman Catholicism still has that cachet of being heavily institutionalized. It's like a leftover prejudice that has nothing to do with the reality of the people gathered in the room, but it's there and it's operative. And so Roman Catholicism isn't going to do the trick. Pentecostalism is definitely there, and it's a quarter Pentecostal, but it's got no ancient future. Not unless yesterday is the ancient future. At most, it's only been around 100 years, and it's just now beginning to work on its theology, so how could it possibly have a liturgy yet? So it's not there. And Protestantism really is. It's aggressive to say it's the thing being fought against or resisted or rebelled against. That's not quite right, but it's very close to right. It's the thing we came out of. It's the thing that damaged us to some extent, or that we don't like. It's the nearest bully on the block to not like. That leaves Anglicanism and Orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is still a little outre in the American experience, and really outre in the UK experience, which is fascinating, and absolutely off the radar screen in Australia and New Zealand. Making it, the what they want are the icons. The icons are cool. The icons are lovely. No idea of how you pray through an icon. No idea what to do with an iconostasis. But the icons we got. But those can be bought at your nearest Hallmark store. You know, they don't necessarily come blessed from the priest. The last one standing, or the only one standing in that, is the Anglican tradition. And that's why the young emergence lady pastor said to me, "We're going to use Hooker's damn stool. But we're going to also tell you guys what's sitting on top of the three legs, because you never decided." They're working in that Anglican tradition, and the Anglican tradition, because it never bought sola scriptura, and because it has the prayers, and because you can make a legitimate argument. Synod of Whitby or no Synod of Whitby in the 6th century, 7th century, you can say that Anglicanism began in the 1st century with the Celts, and you can make that argument. And so there is a kind of natural affinity, and Anglicanism contains in its liturgy things that are very appealing. And I'm amazed at the number of pure emergence gatherings I go into where the Book of Common Prayer is sitting on the coffee table or sitting somewhere around, even occasionally in a rack at the door where you can pick them up. It's there. We had the good sense never to put a copyright on that sucker, and so not only is it there, but it's mightily mauled and reproduced and changed and adapted. And some of you sitting here are guilty because I saw some adaptations in the last 3 or 4 days, because there is no copyright. So there, all of this is to say that when McLaurin was invited to speak at Lambeth, he couched his remarks in terms of the resonance, to some extent, between the Anglican tradition and emergence, and that he didn't put it this way, but if anybody was going to piggyback on anybody, it was going to be emergence piggybacking on the Anglican tradition. He then, somewhat to my amazement, I must confess, 2 months ago issued a paper which he then sent to the Episcopal powers that be and said, "You may now circulate it." And that paper is entitled "Seize the Episcopal Moment." And it is a call from the head of emergence Christianity in this country to the extent that that which is self-organizing and non-hierarchical can have a head. But if there is one, the Fig Newton of the corporate imagination, it would be Brian McLaurin. In which he is making a strong case for the connection between the ancient traditions contained within the Anglican services, and emergence needs for liturgy, and urging that the Episcopal or the Anglican tradition meet them halfway and begin to realize that that affinity is there and that kinship is there. So Seize the Episcopal Moment is the name of the paper. It's now circulating all over the net. But he deliberately handed it to a coterie of bishops. We have more bishops than a dog has fleas, but there are some of them who have gathered as Anglo-Emergent bishops and who are now working within our House of Bishops as the coterie that is Anglo-Emergent bishops. And when the House of Bishops meets for its annual meeting in March, there will be 2 days of that meeting devoted, led by the Anglo-Emergent bishops, and it will be centered around Anglo-Emergents, and it will begin with McLaurin's call to seize the Episcopal Moment. So it's an interesting, and not necessarily chauvinistically reported to you, just simply so that you will know that when this thing gets parked, when it begins to institutionalize, it's going to probably park in a garage that looks and speaks with a British accent to some extent, for very good reasons, unless we can take the British accent out and just borrow the things. But that also makes for an interesting compatibility with UMC. And as I said yesterday at lunch, and we'll say again because it's important, that one, after one of these things happens, whatever holds dominance, whatever had pride of place, in this case Protestantism, has to drop back and reconfigure. It just has to kind of start over, just like Catholicism had to start over with the Council of Trent 500 years ago. This one is dropping back. And one of the best evidences of the dropping back and the reconfiguration is called a common mission, in which, first of all, the Episcopal Church in this country joined with the Lutheran Church. And it did. It took something like 5 years to work out whether or not, indeed, you could have an ordained Lutheran speaking to those elevated children of God who are known as Episcopalians. The reason being that the poor Lutheran never got apostolic succession. He got baptized by just another human being into the profession of being a priest. Shame on him. And we worked our way through that. I'm never quite sure how we jumped the apostolic succession thing, but we did. And now we swap, the two communions swap back and forth. Pulpits, communions, you can merge, congregations, whatever. And the UMC will be part of that union sometime in the next 6 to 8 months, it looks like to me. That's my guess, given where the paperwork is.
United Methodist Church.
Yeah, UMC will be part of that. That's Protestantism reconfiguring. That's finding its way into, still within the institution, and part of what we talked about before lunch, saving the institution. It's part of what those questions are going to have to be answered by this as it reconfigures. That reconfiguration has happened in the UK right from the get-go. I mentioned the fact that Church of Fools was UMC in Britain, and it was their first attempt to address the virtual reality problem. When the Archbishop of Canterbury read McLaurin's book and decided he wanted to buy all of them and hire every loose plane and drop them over the UK, when that didn't prove to be feasible for obvious reasons, and we're now to almost 6 years ago, 5.5 years ago, he instead went back to Lambeth, which is the Episcopal Church's Vatican, or whatever you want to call it. He went back to Lambeth and opened the Office of Fresh Expressions. And the Office of Fresh Expressions is a joint effort between the Church of England and the United Methodist Church, which is why when I was laughing with Lee and Jen, when the Hyphenates met in Memphis, and we had our separate meetings by our tribe in the after-lunch session, we had not been 30 minutes into the Anglo-Emergent meeting before there came a knock on the door. And it was this guy laughing his head off, and he was from down the hall from the Methodist meeting, and he knocked on the door and he stuck his head in and said, "We just thought you all needed to know that we took a vote and we think it's time to come home." Laughing his head off, and then went back and said, "Nah, we're kidding. Wesley would kill us," and went back to the Methodist meeting. You know, but so
Wesley would kill him.
Oh, I don't think so either. I think Wesley died in his rabbit. If you actually read, you know, he died in collar. So saw the light of God. But there is an affinity between Methodism still, because it's not been that separation of that very long. So the Church of the Office of Fresh Expressions was run for the first 5 years by a man named Stephen Kraft, whose book we managed to lose yesterday, and I'm going to have to replace for Bill. He has been replaced, or he was replaced last month by the Archbishop after 5 years. He was elevated to the episcopacy, and he is now a bishop, Kraft, and being put out in the field with the bishop's authority. And he's been replaced by Bishop Graham Cray, which is to say that the Archbishop is making real sure that the authority goes with that effort. And so Fresh Expressions of Church is what we would call an Anglo-Emergent. Sometimes it's an outright emergent. And I realized that I didn't give you, I realized at lunch, that I didn't give you poster children. And I meant to, I think I was so anxious to get the virtual thing over with before we went to lunch that I clutched on some other stuff. Which is to say, if you want to see a British edition of a pure emergence, look at Icon spelled with a K, and your man is Pete Rollins. Rollins is the PhD. This is the reason it irritates me when people say that it's all relative theology and sloppy thinking. And I just want to scream and say, do you know the people you're talking about? Pete Rollins' PhD is in postmodern philosophy. The argument being that a philosopher can perhaps deal more honestly with theology now than can a trained theologian. Not news you might want to hear, but argued from the point of view that going to seminary teaches you to think theologically, which is to say it conditions you. And that in order to look new wine needs new wineskins. And therefore took the PhD in philosophy, which is close to what you were saying. Seminaries are a no-no. Seminaries are an if. They're not a no-no. They're an iffy. Simply because seminaries came with the Reformation. They were one of the things Luther protested, and the Reformation gave us our first seminaries. So they're suspect. You can go, but you shouldn't be allowed to be programmed. And Rollins, therefore, chose to do the doctorate in philosophy, saying it was the nearest thing. His other choice was physics. And if I were 25 or 30 now and growing up in Christianity as it is right now, I would take at least an undergraduate degree in some form of physics. I don't know which division, but it's incomprehensible to me that anybody could be preparing for the ministry now without a serious background in one of the physical sciences. And physics, I think, is the one that probably needs to happen the most. But anyway, making that decision, then Rollins went forth and allowed Icon to grow up, if you will, out of an emergent group around him. And it did the same thing. It was a small group. It started in a pub, and it kind of growed like Topsy, as they used to say in the mountains when I grew up. It just became bigger and bigger, and then he became full-time as the worship leader. Rather than clergy is seen as a privileged position, and privilege is not good in emergent Christianity. So his role description is that of pastor. He has dropped back a little bit from Icon now in order to become one of the leading theologians of emergent thinking. And how not to think of God, how not to speak of God, yes, you read it, Susan, yeah, how not to speak of God is one you need to look at. The Fidelity of Betrayal is a new title. He has just applied for, there is a large emergent church called Trinity. Ian Crone is the pastor in Greenwich, Connecticut. And Pete will be 3 years in this country under the aegis of Trinity. Ian is going to go on the road and begin to learn some stuff and take a little sabbatical, and he's turning over his congregation. Trinity, I think, is about 17,000 members in that. Yes.
You can find freshexpressions.org.
Yes, you can. Absolutely. Thank you.
And in that disappearing book, you can also, in Canada, it's called...
the book that's no longer.
It's called Messy Church.
Messy Church. Thank you. Absolutely.
That's where I found that information.
Yes. Messy Church. And if you're looking for a Fresh Expressions one, look at Moot, M-O-O-T, not M-U-T-E, and your man there is Ian Mosby. And he, too, Ian... Ian has two books out. I think they're on the bibliography, as a matter of fact. The doctrine, the emergence doctrine of the Trinity, is probably better developed by Mobsby than it is by Rollins. Probably the best, M-O-B-S-B-Y, and it's Mobsby or Mobsby, according to which one you want to say. He answers to both. And I've never for the life of me figured out which one's for real, because he won't say. But if you want to say, and Moot also will have a presence, just moot.com. We'll have a presence on the net, and you can see what they're doing. I have not been yet to a Moot service. I have been to an Icon service. Some of them are truly remarkable. The one I remember best was at Advent, and it actually happened in a church in Richmond, Virginia, where the Icon people came over to show some Anglo-Emergents of what it was that they did. And they did an Icon service there, and the service was to be at 3:15. See, I promised I wouldn't talk. Okay, but I just thought of all this during lunch. Okay, Bill's going to collect $10 before this is over. But the service was to be at 10:15, and we are in the first week of Advent. When everybody gets there, I was fortunate. I was there to observe, and so I was already in the chancel. But the doors are locked. There's no getting in. About 5 minutes later, 3:20, the knocks begin on the door. You know, let us in. And Pete sent somebody out to say, "We're sorry, we're having trouble. If you'll just wait a few more minutes, we'll unlock the doors." By 3:30, the doors are still, and it's November. 3:30, the doors are still locked. And Pete sends somebody, nods, and they go out and they open the doors. And the people come in, a little disconcerted, but they come in, and nothing happens. They just sit there. And in a few minutes, one of the musicians gets up, who's actually playing electric guitar, gets up and goes up to the lectern where the boxes are, the acoustical equipment, and he begins to tune the guitar. Gets it to his pleasure, quits it, goes and sits down. Happens. About, I guess, 10 of 4 it was, a girl got up and from the Icon Company and went up to the microphone and said, "We're just having a little trouble. If you'll be patient with us, we're going to start in a few minutes." Sits down. Nothing happens. Nothing happens at all. And finally, at 4:05, Pete stands up and says, "Welcome to Advent. We're waiting." And takes off from there, and it was the most magical moment. It sounds corny when you tell it, but it was absolutely the most the woman 2 rows behind me just suddenly burst into tears, and I don't know how many people told me later, never thought of it that way, never thought of it as waiting. And then we had a complete Eucharist, which involved chalices that were beer bottles, and no attempt to offend. There's no intention of offending, but just were in the stuff was in beer bottles, and the bread was just on paper plates, and we fed each other, and we said our closing prayers, and then Pete went back up and he pulled from under the podium envelopes, and he said, "Our community has prepared for each of you this message. And will you please take the envelope, each of you as you leave? And on Thanksgiving Day, when you are gathered in your homes, would you open this and remember again with us who are on the other side of the ocean that this is indeed Advent?" And so everybody got an envelope. And everybody had a message from the Icon community to be part of their Thanksgiving service. And there was some small little gift, a bookmark or something in there from Icon as a memento of the service. It was a marvelously effective thing. A good emergent service is hugely effective. And you asked me a very good question when you said, would you say why it is that the regular ones... It's because whatever that factor is, that's X factor. And X factor is there in every emergent service. and it's what's missing in the establishments.
Not predictable.
It's not predictable. It's tense. It was miserable. It was absolutely miserable by the time they finally, by the time he finally got up there at 5:04, it was absolutely exquisitely anxious.
Did anybody walk out?
No. Amazingly enough, I was so surprised. I think, had I not known what was coming, walked out. But nobody left. Yeah.
So does the X factor always evoke some type of emotional response?
The X factor always evokes some kind of incarnational response, which may be emotional, which I guess, how can you separate the two? But yes, there is always that. But this was a physical tension. Part of the emotion was, oh, I mean, you could feel, I was on the third row, and I could feel that Nave getting more and more physically involved. And when he finally said, "It is Advent," and we're waiting. And so it was emotional. Obviously, the woman burst into tears behind me, and she was a grown woman. But there's a physical element to the, a distinctly incarnational element to emergence worship every single time. Every single time. So anyway, icon is worth looking at in terms of an outright emergence in British edition. Moot is worth looking at as probably the best example right now of what a fresh expressions looks like. Ian is a priest, ordained, fully ordained priest in the Anglican Communion. He sees his sitting diocese far more than once a year. He's in the bishop's pocket all the time. He's right outside of London, so it's the Bishop of London to whom he reports. But they're examples that are worth looking at, so you actually see what this thing looks like. Now that we've got another sitting bishop actually in charge of Fresh Expressions, I have no doubt we'll be seeing more and more of that kind of thing. One last thing, and then I really, for all my teasing of Bill, I will have violated my pledge to give it back to you. I want to call to your attention the fact that there are variations that we did not talk about. And when we spoke of acts of inhumane kindness, which I find a very compelling part of emergence theology, that you can so intellectualize it that it doesn't do your soul any good, and all it does is change the sociological context or the cultural context in which you exercise it. There is, at the same time, a huge sense of social justice. A quarter of emergents are social justice Christians, and they are deeply involved in social justice and in caring for those who have less. And one of the best examples of it is Ecclesia Ministries. And I would urge you to look at Ecclesia Ministries when you're Googling also. Ecclesia Ministries just happens to be Anglican again, and I think it's just a happenstance. It now is 80 congregations in this country, and I think it's 2 or 3 abroad. It was started by a woman named Debbie Little, Wyman Little, who was priest at St. Paul's Cathedral in Boston. And said that she did the 8:30 service one Sunday morning, and she said, you know, when it was all over, I've heard her, she's told this to me privately as well as publicly, when it was all over that Sunday morning, I had just passed that cup and given the body of God to people who could have cared less. They were there to go through the routine so that they would be through by 9:30 so they could go on with Sunday. And I just couldn't stand it. And she said, suddenly I was mad as hell, quote, end quote. And I took that chalice and I took that paten and I walked straight down that nave aisle and I walked through those doors and I walked over to the park where the homeless had gathered because it was cold, it was December. And I said to them, would you like some food? Would you like something to drink? Until the paten and was free of bread and there was no more wine in the chalice, and I began to feed them. And as I came back in my anger, I heard the voice of God saying, this is what you're supposed to be doing all along. This is what it was all about. And she said, I never did. God's going to make me quit. Okay. I never served again in St. Paul's, but St. Paul's supported me while I spent 2 months on the streets with bread and wine, trying to find out, how one ministers to homeless without insulting them, without hurting their dignity, and learns to minister to them. And she said, I learned. And so we had our first Ecclesia community, And now there are 80 of them, the most famous of which happened in Atlanta last October, and last September, in which Pastor Bob was a candidate for, he was a deacon. First he was a seminarian in Atlanta, and then he was a deacon, and he had opened an ecclesia ministry in the park, right off of Peachtree, Woodruff Park to be exact, right off of Peachtree. And it came time every Sunday. They were there. They had a perfectly normal outdoor, everybody homeless, nobody's got anywhere to go. Homeless ministry, a perfectly normal Anglican service. It was right there. And then there were two empty stores near the park where somehow Pastor Bob had managed to get a pro bono lawyer to come in one day a week and talk with the homeless about things, had managed to get a nurse and a physician to come in pro bono and take care of them one day a week. It's a limit to what you can do. And he had persuaded the cathedral to pay the rent on these two abandoned buildings, which ran to something like $150 a month or something. It was ridiculous because they were pathetically run down. But Pastor Bob came up ready for ordination. He had finished his year of the diaconate. And it was time, he finished his seminary, and it was time to ordain. And so the bishop coadjutor of Atlanta, Bishop Mitchell, came to do it along with 13 other bishops, and they were going to do this thing in Woodruff Park, and they were going to do it right. And they got ready to do the apostolic succession. They got ready, Bishop put his hand on Pastor Bob. And suddenly, for the 3 or 4 years that Pastor Bob had been pastoring this congregation, this man had never seen, one of the men, had never seen an ordination before. And he just stepped up and said, "My pastor," and pushed the bishop's hand over like this and put his hand on Pastor Bob's head like this. So you can get apostolic succession bilateral, I guess. But he did. And somebody, fortunately, was standing there with a camera and caught it. And the Diocese of Atlanta ran it on YouTube for it. But seeing this man come up, my pastor, and laid his hands on, which is emergence. See, that's the X factor, totally unintended. There was a parish in Alpharetta, Georgia, right up the road, that every Sunday a different parish provides the meal after the services. And the one in Alpharetta had prepared this huge meal because it was an ordination feast. The women from Alpharetta said, "We couldn't even serve the food. We were so overcome by the fact that we had just seen a real ordination," which was how they put it. "We've seen a real ordination." That kind of ministry, when you start doing, you have to love the people, I think is what I was trying to say. It's obvious that Bob and his wife, they co-pastor that. Bob and his wife had spent 3 years of his seminary training loving that parish, and it's a parish just as sure as any other one, and it never saw a building in its life and never will, and it'll never earn a bit of money for anybody. It'll cost something, but it's there and filled with devout Christians who just don't play those same rules. Enough about that.